Old man. When the woman asked him if he had a knife, standing there in the streaming, bed-ticking garments which had got him shot at, the second time by a machine gun, on the two occasions when he had seen any human life after leaving the levee 4 days ago, the convict felt exactly as he had in the fleeing skiff when the woman suggested that they had better hurry. He felt the same outrageous affronting of a condition purely moral, the same raging impotence to find any answer to it. So that, standing above her, spent, suffocating, and inarticulate, it was a full minute before he comprehended that she was now crying, the can in the boat. He did not anticipate what she could want with it. He did not even wonder, nor stop to ask. He turned, running. This time, he thought, it's another moccasin, as the thick body truncated in that awkward reflex which had nothing of alarm in it, but only alertness. He not even shifting his stride, though he knew his running foot would fall within a yard of the flat head. The bow of the skiff was well up the slope now, where the wave had set it, and there was another snake just crawling over the stern into it. And as he stooped for the bailing can, he saw something else swimming toward the mound. He didn't know what. A head, a face at the apex of a V of ripples. He snatched up the can. By pure juxtaposition of it and water, he scooped it full, already turning. He saw the deer again, or another one. That is, he saw a deer. A side glance. The light, smoke-colored phantom in a cypress vista, then gone, vanished, he not pausing to look after it, galloping back to the woman and kneeling with the can to her lips until she told him better. It had contained a pint of beans or tomatoes, something, hermetically sealed and opened by 4 blows of an axe heel, the metal flap turned back, the jagged edges razor sharp. She told him how, and he used this in lieu of a knife. He removed one of his shoelaces and cut it in two with the sharp tin. Then she wanted warm water. "If I just had a little hot water," she said in a weak, serene voice without particular hope. Only when he thought of matches, it was again a good deal like when she had asked him if he had a knife. Until she fumbled in the pocket of the shrunken tunic. It had a darker double V on one cuff and a darker blotch on one shoulder, where service stripes and a divisional emblem had been ripped off, but this meant nothing to him, and produced a matchbox contrived by telescoping 2 shotgun shells. So he drew her back a little from the water and went to hunt dry wood enough to burn, thinking this time, it's just another snake, only, he said, he should have thought, 10,000 other snakes. And now he knew it was not the same deer, because he saw 3 at one time. Does or bucks, he did not know which, since they were all antlerless in May, and, besides, he had never seen one of any kind anywhere before, except on a Christmas card. And then the rabbit, drowned, dead anyway, already torn open, the bird, the hawk, standing upon it, the erected crest, the hard, vicious, patrician nose, the intolerant, omnivorous yellow eye, and he kicking at it, kicking it lurching and broad-winged into the actual air. When he returned with the wood and the dead rabbit, the baby, wrapped in the tunic, lay wedged between 2 cypress knees, and the woman was not in sight, though while the convict knelt in the mud, blowing and nursing his meager flame, she came, slowly and weakly, from the direction of the water. Then, the water heated at last, and there produced from somewhere he was never to know, she herself perhaps never to know until the need comes, no woman perhaps ever to know. Only no woman will even wonder, that square of something somewhere between sackcloth and silk. Squatting, his own wet garments steaming in the fire's heat, he watched her bathe the child with a savage curiosity and interest that became amazed unbelief, so that at last he stood above them both, looking down at the tiny terracotta-colored creature resembling nothing, and thought, "And this is all. This is what severed me violently from all I ever knew and did not wish to leave, and cast me upon a medium I was born to fear, to fetch up at last in a place I never saw before, and where I do not even know where I am." Then he returned to the water and refilled the bailing can. It was drawing toward sunset now, or what would have been sunset, save for the high prevailing overcast, of this day whose beginning he could not even remember, when he returned to where the fire burned in the interlaced gloom of the cypresses. Even after this short absence, evening had definitely come, as though darkness too had taken refuge upon that quarter-acre mound, that earthen ark out of Genesis, that dim, wet, cypress-choked, life-teeming, constricted desolation. In what direction and how far from what and where, he had no more idea than of the day of the month, and had now, with the setting of the sun, crept forth again to spread upon the waters. He stewed the rabbit in sections while the fire burned redder and redder in the darkness, where the shy, wild eyes of small animals, once the tall, mild, almost plate-sized stare of one of the deer, glowed and vanished and glowed again, the broth hot and rank after the 4 days. He seemed to hear the roar of his own saliva as he watched the woman sip the first canful. Then he drank too. They ate the other fragments which had been charring and scorching on willow twigs. It was full night now. "You and him better sleep in the boat," the convict said. "We want to get an early start tomorrow." He shoved the bow of the skiff off the land so it would lie level. He lengthened the painter with a piece of grapevine and returned to the fire and tied the grapevine about his wrist and lay down. It was mud he lay upon, but it was solid underneath. It was earth. It did not move. If you fell upon it, you broke your bones against its incontrovertible passivity sometimes, but it did not accept you substanceless and enveloping and suffocating, down and down and down. It was hard at times to drive a plow through. It sent you spent, weary, and cursing its light-long, insatiable demands back to your bunk at sunset at times. But it did not snatch you violently out of all familiar knowing and sweep you, thrall and impotent, for days against any returning. "I don't know where I am, and I don't reckon I know the way back to where I want to go," he thought. "But at least the boat has stopped long enough to give me a chance to turn it around." He waked at dawn, the light faint, the sky jonquil-colored. The day would be fine. The fire had burned out. On the opposite side of the cold ashes lay three snakes, motionless and parallel as underscoring. And in the swiftly making light others seemed to materialize. Earth, which an instant before had been mere earth, broke up into motionless coils and loops. Branches, which a moment before had been mere branches, now become immobile ophidian festoons, even as the convict stood thinking about food, about something hot before they started. But he decided against this, against wasting this much time, since there still remained in the skiff quite a few of the rock-like objects which the shanty woman had flung into it. Besides, thinking this, no matter how fast nor successfully he hunted, he would never be able to lay up enough food to get them back to where they wanted to go. So he returned to the skiff, paying himself back to it by his vine-spliced painter, back to the water on which a low mist, thick as cotton batting, though apparently not very tall, deep, lay, into which the stern of the skiff was already beginning to disappear, although it lay with its prow almost touching the mound. The woman waked, stirred. "We're fixing to start now," she said. "Yeah," the convict said. "You ain't aiming to have another one this morning, are you?" He got in and shoved the skiff clear of the land, which immediately began to dissolve into the mist. "Hand me the oar," he he said over his shoulder, not turning yet.
The oar?
He turned his head. The oar, you're laying on it. But she was not, and for an instant, during which the mound, the island, continued to fade slowly into the mist, which seemed to enclose the skiff in weightless and impalpable wool, like a precious or fragile bauble or jewel, the convict squatted not in dismay, but in that frantic and astonished outrage of a man who, having just escaped a falling safe, is struck by the following 2-ounce paperweight which was sitting on it. This the more unbearable, because he knew that never in his life had he less time to give way to it, because he did not hesitate. Grasping the grapevine end, he sprang into the water, vanishing in the violent action of climbing, and reappeared, still climbing, and, who had never learned to swim, plunged and threshed on toward the almost vanished mound, moving through the water, then upon it as the deer had done yesterday, and scrabbled up the muddy slope, and lay gasping and panting, still clutching the grapevine end. Now the first thing he did was to choose what he believed to be the most suitable tree. For an instant, in which he knew he was insane, he thought of trying to saw it down with the flange of the baling can, and build a fire against the butt of it. Then he went to seek food. He spent the next 6 days seeking it, while the tree burned through and fell, and burned through again at the proper length, and he nursing little constant cunning flames along the flanks of the log to make it paddle-shaped, nursing them at night, too, while the woman and baby, it was eating, nursing now, he turning his back or even retiring into the woods each time she prepared to open the faded tunic, slept in the skiff. He learned to watch for stooping hawks, and so found more rabbits, and twice possums. They ate some drowned fish, which gave them both a rash, and then a violent flux, and one snake, which the woman thought was turtle, and which did them no harm. And one night it rained, and he got up and dragged brush, shaking the snakes. He no longer thought, it ain't nothing but another moccasin. He just stepped aside for them, as they, when there was time, telescoped sullenly aside for him. Out of it, with the old former feeling of personal invulnerability, and built a shelter, and the rain stopped at once, and did not recommence, and the woman went back to the skiff. Then one night, the slow, tedious, charring log was almost a paddle now. One night, and he was in bed, in his bed in the bunkhouse, and it was cold. He was trying to pull the covers up, only his mule wouldn't let him, prodding and bumping heavily at him, trying to get into the narrow bed with him. And now the bed was cold, too, and wet, and he was trying to get out of it, only the mule would not let him, holding him by his belt in its teeth, jerking and bumping him back into the cold, wet bed, and, leaning, gave him a long swipe across the face with its cold, limber, musculated tongue. And he waked to no fire, no coal even beneath where the almost finished paddle had been charring. And something else prolonged and coldly limber passed swiftly across his body where he lay in 4 inches of water, while the nose of the skiff alternately tugged at the grapevine tied about his waist and bumped and shoved him back into the water again. Then something else came up and began to nudge at his ankle. The log, the oar it was. Even as he groped frantically for the skiff, hearing the swift rustling going to and fro inside the hull, as the woman began to thrash about and scream.
"Rats!" she cried. "It's full of rats!" "Lay still!" he cried. "It's just snakes. Can't you hold still long enough for me to find the boat?"
Then he found it. He got into it with the unfinished paddle. Again the thick, muscular body convulsed under his foot. It did not strike. He would not have cared, glaring astern where he could see a little, the faint outer luminosity of the open water. He pulled toward it, thrusting aside the snake-looped branches, the bottom of the skiff resounding faintly to thick, solid plops, the woman shrieking steadily. Then the skiff was clear of the trees, the mound, and now he could feel the bodies whipping about his ankles and hear the rasp of them as they went over the gunwale. He drew the log in and scooped it forward along the bottom of the boat and up and out. Against the pallid water, he could see three more of them in lashing convolutions before they vanished.
"Shut up!" he cried. "Hush! I wish I was a snake so I could get out, too!"
When once more the pale and heatless wafer disk of the early sun stared down at the skiff, whether they were moving or not, the convict did not know. In its nimbus of fine cotton batting, the convict was hearing again that sound which he had heard twice before and would never forget, that sound of deliberate and irresistible and monstrously disturbed water. But this time he could not tell from what direction it came. It seemed to be everywhere, waxing and fading. It was like a phantom behind the mist, at one instant miles away, the next on the point of overwhelming the skiff within the next second. Suddenly, in the instant, he would believe, his whole weary body would spring and scream, that he was about to drive the skiff point-blank into it, and with the unfinished paddle of the color and texture of sooty bricks, like something gnawed out of an old chimney by beavers and weighing 25 pounds, he would whirl the skiff frantically and find the sound dead ahead of him again. Then something bellowed tremendously above his head. He heard human voices. A bell jangled and the sound ceased. And the mist vanished like when you draw your hand across a frosted pane. And the skiff now lay upon a sunny glitter of brown water, flank to flank with, and about 30 yards away from, a steamboat. The decks were crowded and packed with men, women, and children, sitting or standing beside and among a homely conglomeration of hurried furniture, who looked mournfully and silently down into the skiff while the convict and the man with a megaphone in the pilot house talked to each other in alternate puny shouts and roars above the chuffing of the reversed engines.
"What in hell are you trying to do? Commit suicide?
Which is the way to Vicksburg?"
"Vicksburg? Vicksburg? Lay alongside and come aboard."
"Will you take the boat, too?"
"Boat? Boat?"
Now the megaphone cursed, the roaring waves of blasphemy and biological supposition, empty, cavernous, and bodiless in turn, as if the water, the air, the mist had spoken it, roaring the words, then taking them back to itself, and no harm done, no scar, no insult left anywhere.
"If I took aboard every floating sardine can you son of bitch and mush rats want me to, I wouldn't even have room forward for a leadsman. Come aboard. Do you expect me to hang here on stern engines till hell freezes?"
"I ain't coming without the boat," the convict said. Now another voice spoke, so calm and mild and sensible that for a moment it sounded more foreign and out of place than even the megaphone's bellowing and bodiless profanity.
"Where is it you are trying to go?"
"I ain't trying," the convict said. "I'm going. Parchman." The man who had spoken last turned and appeared to converse with a third man in the pilot house. Then he looked down at the skiff again.
"Carnarvon?"
"What?" the convict said.
"Parchman?"
"All right. We're going that way. We'll put you off where you can get home. Come aboard."
"The boat, too?"
"Yes, yes. Come along. We're burning coal just to talk to you." So the convict came alongside then and watched them help the woman and baby over the rail, and he came aboard himself, though he still held to the end of the vine-spliced painter until the skiff was hoisted onto the boiler deck. "My God," the man, the gentle one, said, "is that what you have been using for a paddle?"
"Yeah," the convict said. "I lost the plank."
"The plank," the mild man, the convict told how he seemed to whisper it. "The plank. Well, come along and get something to eat. Your boat is all right now.
I reckon I'll wait here, the convict said.
Because now, he told them, he began to notice for the first time that the other people, the other refugees who crowded the deck, who had gathered in a quiet circle about the upturned skiff on which he and the woman sat, the grapevine painter wrapped several times about his wrist and clutched in his hand, staring at him and the woman with queer, hot, mournful intensity, were not white people.
"You mean niggers?" the plump convict said.
"No, not Americans."
"Not Americans? You was clean out of America, even?"
"I don't know," the tall one said. "They called it Atchafalaya." Because after a while he said, "What?" to the man, and the man did it again. Gobble, gobble.
"Gobble, gobble,"
the plump convict said.
"That's the way they talked," the tall one said.
"Gobble, gobble, wang, caw, caw, toot, toot."
And he sat there and watched them gobbling at one another, and then looking at him again. Then they fell back, and the mild man, he wore a Red Cross brassard, entered, followed by a waiter with a tray of food. The mild man carried two glasses of whiskey.
"Drink this," the mild man said. "This will warm you."
The woman took hers and drank it, but the convict told how he looked at his and thought, "I ain't tasted whiskey in 7 years." He had not tasted it but once before that. It was at the still itself, back in a pine hollow. He was 17. He had gone there with 4 companions, 2 of whom were grown men, 1 of 22 or 23, the other about 40. He remembered it. That is, he remembered perhaps a third of that evening. A fierce turmoil in the hell-colored firelight, the shock and shock of blows about his head, and likewise of his own fists on other hard bone. Then the waking to a splitting and blinding sun in a place, a cowshed, he had never seen before, and which later turned out to be 20 miles from his home. He said he thought of this, and he looked about at the faces watching him, and he said,
"I reckon not."
"Come, come," the mild man said.
"Drink it."
"I don't want it."
"Nonsense," the mild man said. "I'm a doctor. Here. Then you can eat."
So he took the glass, and even then he hesitated. But again the mild man said,
"Come along, down with it. You're still holding us up."
In that voice, still, calm, and sensible, but a little sharp, too. The voice of a man who could keep calm and affable because he wasn't used to being crossed. And he drank the whiskey, and even in the second between the sweet, full fire in his belly and when it began to happen, he was trying to say,
"I tried to tell you, I tried to."
But it was too late now, in the pallid sun glare of the 10th day of terror and hopelessness and despair and impotence and rage and outrage. And it was himself and the mule, his mule. They had let him name it, John Henry, which no man save he had plowed for 5 years now, and whose ways and habits he knew and respected, and who knew his ways and habits so well that each of them could anticipate the other's very movements and intentions. It was himself and the mule, the little gobbling faces flying before them, the familiar, hard skull bones shocking against his fists, his voice shouting,
"Come on, John Henry, plow them down, gobble them down, boy."
Even as the bright-hot, red wave turned back, meeting it joyously, happily, lifted, poised, then hurling through space, triumphant and yelling, then again the old shocking blow at the back of his head. He lay on the deck, flat on his back and pinned arm and leg, and cold sober again, his nostrils gushing again. The mild man stooping over him, with behind the thin, rimless glasses, the coldest eyes the convict had ever seen. Eyes which the convict said were not looking at him, but at the gushing blood, with nothing in the world in them but complete, impersonal interest.
Good man, the mild man said. Plenty of life in the old carcass yet, eh? Plenty of good red blood, too. Anyone ever suggest to you that you were hemophilic?
What? The plump convict said. Hemophilic? You know what that means?
The tall convict had his cigarette going now. His body jackknifed backward into the coffin-like space between the upper and lower bunks. Lean, clean, motionless, the blue smoke wreathing across his lean, dark, aquiline, shaven face.
That's a calf. That's a bull and a cow at the same time.
No, it ain't, a third convict said. It's a calf or colt that ain't neither one.
Hellfire, the plump one said.
He's got to be one or the other to keep from drowning.
He had never ceased to look at the tall one in the bunk. Now he spoke to him again.
You let him call you that?
The tall one had done so. He did not answer the doctor. This was where he stopped thinking of him as the mild man, at all. He could not move either, though he felt fine. He felt better than he had in 10 days. So they helped him to his feet and steadied him over and lowered him onto the upturned skiff beside the woman, where he sat, bent forward, elbows on knees in the immemorial attitude, watching his own bright crimson staining the mud-trodden deck, until the doctor's clean-clipped hand appeared under his nose with a file.
Smell, the doctor said.
Deep.
The convict inhaled. The sharp ammoniac sensation burned up his nostrils and into his throat.
Again, the doctor said.
The convict inhaled obediently. This time he choked and spat a gout of blood. His nose now had no more feeling than a toenail, other than it felt about the size of a 10-inch shovel and as cold.
I ask you to excuse me, he said. I never meant...
Why, the doctor said. You put up as pretty a scrap against 40 or 50 men as I ever saw. You lasted a good 2 seconds. Now you can eat something. Or do you think that will send you haywire again?
They both ate, sitting on the skiff, the gobbling faces no longer watching them now, the convict gnawing slowly and painfully at the thick sandwich, hunched, his face laid sideways to the food and parallel to the earth, as a dog chews. The steamboat went on. At noon there were bowls of hot soup and bread and more coffee. They ate this, too, sitting side by side on the skiff, the grapevine still wrapped about the convict's wrist. The baby waked and nursed and slept again, and they talked quietly.
Was it Parchman he said he was going to take us?
That's where I told him I wanted to go.
It never sounded exactly like Parchman to me. It sounded like he said something else.
The convict had thought that, too. He had been thinking about that fairly soberly ever since they boarded the steamboat, and soberly indeed ever since he had remarked the nature of the other passengers, those men and women definitely a little shorter than he, and with skin a little different in pigmentation from any sunburn, even though the eyes were sometimes blue or gray, who talked to one another in a tongue he had never heard before, and who apparently did not understand his own, people the like of whom he had never seen about Parchman nor anywhere else, and whom he did not believe were going there or beyond there either. But after his hillbilly country fashion and kind, he would not ask, because to his raising, asking information was asking a favor, and you did not ask favors of strangers. If they offered them, perhaps you accepted, and you expressed gratitude almost tediously recapitulant, but you did not ask. So he would watch and wait, as he had done before, and do, or try to do to the best of his ability, what the best of his judgment dictated. So he waited, and in mid-afternoon the steamboat chuffed and thrust through a willow-choked gorge and emerged from it, and now the convict knew it was the river. He could believe it now, the tremendous reach, yellow and sleepy in the afternoon.
Because it's too big,
he told them soberly. Ain't no flood in the world big enough to make it do more than stand a little higher, so it can look back and see just where the flea is, just exactly where to scratch. It's the little ones, the little piddling creeks that run backward one day and forward the next, and come busting down on a man full of dead mules and henhouses. And the steamboat moving up this now, like an ant crossing a plate, the convict thought. Sitting beside the woman on the upturned skiff, the baby nursing again, apparently looking too out across the water, where, a mile away on either hand, the twin lines of levee resembled parallel, unbroken, floating thread. And then it was nearing sunset, and he began to hear, to notice, the voices of the doctor and of the man who had first bawled at him through the megaphone, now bawling again from the pilot house overhead.
Stop! Stop! Am I running a streetcar?
Stop for the novelty, then, the doctor's pleasant voice said. I don't know how many trips back and forth you have made in yonder, nor how many of what you call mush rats you have fetched out. But this is the first time you ever had two people, no, three, who not only knew the name of some place they wished to go, but were actually trying to go there. So the convict waited, while the sun slanted more and more, and the steamboat ant crawled steadily on across its vacant and gigantic plate, turning more and more to copper. But he did not ask, he just waited. Maybe it was Carrollton, he said, he thought. It begun with a C. But he did not believe that either. He did not know where he was, but he did know that this was not anywhere near the Carrollton he remembered from that day 7 years ago, when, shackled wrist to wrist with the deputy sheriff, he had passed through it on the train. The slow, spaced, repeated, shattering banging of trucks where two railroads crossed, a random scattering of white houses, tranquil among trees on green hills lush with summer, a pointing spire, the finger of the hand of God. But there was no river there. And you ain't never close to this river without knowing it, he thought. I don't care who you are nor where you have been all your life. Then the head of the steamboat began to swing across the stream, its shadow swinging too, traveling long before it across the water toward the vacant ridge of willow-mast earth, empty of all life. There was nothing there at all. The convict could not even see either earth or water beyond it. It was as though the steamboat were about to crash slowly through the thin, low, frail willow barrier and embark into space. Or lacking this, slow and back and fill and disembark him into space. Granted it was about to disembark him, granted this was that place which was not near Parchman and was not Carrollton either, even though it did begin with C. Then he turned his head and saw the doctor stooping over the woman, pushing the baby's eyelid up with his forefinger, peering at it. "Who else was there when he came?" the doctor said.
"Nobody," the convict said.
"Did it all yourselves, eh?"
"Yes," the convict said. Now the doctor stood up and looked at the convict.
"This is Carnarvon," he said.
"Carnarvon?" the convict said. "That ain't—"
Then he stopped, ceased. And now he told about that, the intent eyes as dispassionate as ice behind the rimless glasses, the clipped, quick-tempered face that was not accustomed to being crossed or lied to either.
"Yes," the plump convict said. "That's what I was aiming to ask. Them clothes. Anybody would know them. How if this doctor was as smart as you claim he was?"
"I had slept in them for 10 nights, mostly in the mud," the tall one said. "I'd been rowing since midnight with that sapling oar I had tried to burn out that I never had time to scrape the soot off. But it's being scared and worried, and then scared and then worried again in clothes for days and days and days that changes the way they look. I don't mean just your pants." He did not laugh. "Your face, too. That doctor knowed."
"All right," the plump one said. "Go on."
"I know it," the doctor said. "I discovered that while you were lying on the deck yonder, sobering up again. Now don't lie to me. I don't like lying. This boat is going to New Orleans. No, the convict said immediately, quietly, with absolute finality. He could hear them again, the thuck, thuck, thuck on the water where an instant before he had been. But he was not thinking of the bullets. He had forgotten them, forgiven them. He was thinking of himself, crouching, sobbing, panting before running again. The voice, the indictment, the cry of final and irrevocable repudiation of the old primal, faithless manipulator of all the lust and folly and injustice. All in the world I wanted was just to surrender. Thinking of it, remembering it, but without heat now, without passion now, and briefer than an epitaph. No, I tried that once. They shot at me. So you don't want to go to New Orleans, and you didn't exactly plan to go to Carnarvon, but you will take Carnarvon in preference to New Orleans. The convict said nothing. The doctor looked at him, the magnified pupils like the heads of two bridge nails. What were you in for? Hit him harder than you thought, eh? No, I tried to rob a train. Say that again. The convict said it again. Well, go on. You don't say that in the year 1927 and just stop, man. So the convict told it, dispassionately, too, about the magazines, the pistol which would not shoot, the mask and the dark lantern in which no draft had been arranged to keep the candle burning so that it died almost with the match, but even then left the metal too hot to carry, one with subscriptions. Only it ain't my eyes or my mouth either he's watching, he thought. It's like he is watching the way my hair grows on my head. I see, the doctor said. But something went wrong. But you've had plenty of time to think about it since, to decide what was wrong, what you failed to do. Yes, the convict said. I've thought about it a right smart since. So next time you are not going to make that mistake. I don't know, the convict said. There ain't going to be a next time. Why? If you know what you did wrong, they won't catch you next time. The convict looked at the doctor steadily. They looked at each other steadily. The two sets of eyes were not so different after all. I reckon I see what you mean, the convict said presently. I was 18 then. I'm 25 now. Oh, the doctor said. Now, the convict tried to tell it. The doctor did not move. He just simply quit looking at the convict. He produced a pack of cheap cigarettes from his coat. Smoke, he said. I wouldn't care for none, the convict said. Quite, the doctor said in that affable, clipped voice. He put the cigarettes away. There has been conferred upon my race, the medical race, also the power to bind and to loose, if not by Jehovah, perhaps, certainly by the American Medical Association, on which, incidentally, in this day of our Lord, I would put my money at any odds, at any amount, at any time. I don't know just how far out of bounds I am on this specific occasion, but I think we'll put it to the touch. He cupped his hands to his mouth, toward the pilot house overhead. Captain, he shouted, we'll put these three passengers ashore here. He turned to the convict again. Yes, he said, I think I shall let your native state lick its own vomit. Here. Again his hand emerged from his pocket, this time with a bill in it. No, the convict said. Come, come, I don't like to be disputed either. No, the convict said, I ain't got any way to pay it back. Did I ask you to pay it back? No, the convict said, I never asked to borrow it either. So once more he stood on dry land, who had already been toyed with twice by that risible and concentrated power of water, once more than should have fallen to the lot of any one man, any one lifetime, yet for whom there was reserved still another unbelievable recapitulation, he and the woman standing on the empty levee, the sleeping child wrapped in the faded tunic, and the grapevine painter still wrapped about the convict's wrist, watching the steamboat back away and turn and once more crawl onward up the platter-like reach of vacant water, burnished more and more to copper, its trailing smoke roiling in slow, copper-edged gouts, thinning out along the water, fading, stinking away across the vast, serene desolation, the boat growing smaller and smaller until it did not seem to crawl at all, but to hang stationary in the airy, substanceless sunset, dissolving into nothing like a petal of floating mud. Then he turned, and for the first time looked about him, behind him, recoiling, not through fear, but through pure reflex, and not physically, but the soul, the spirit, that profound, sober, alert attentiveness of the hillman, who will not ask anything of strangers, not even information, thinking quietly. No, this ain't Carrollton neither. Because he now looked down the almost perpendicular landward slope of the levee, through 60 feet of absolute space, upon a surface, a terrain flat as a waffle, and of the color of a waffle, or perhaps of the summer coat of a claybank horse, and possessing that same piled density of a rug or peltry, spreading away without undulation, yet with that curious appearance of imponderable solidity, like fluid, broken here and there by thick humps of arsenical green, which nevertheless still seemed to possess no height, and by writhen veins of the color of ink, which he began to suspect to be actual water, but with judgment still reserved, even when presently he was walking in it. That's what he said, told. So they went on. He didn't tell how he got the skiff single-handed up the revetment and across the crown and down the opposite 60-foot drop. He just said he went on, in a swirling cloud of mosquitoes like hot cinders, thrusting and plunging through the saw-edged grass which grew taller than his head and which whipped back at his arms and face like limber knives, dragging by the vine-spliced painter the skiff in which the woman sat, slogging and stumbling knee-deep in something less of earth than water, along one of those black winding channels less of water than earth. And then he was in the skiff, too, now, paddling with the charred log, what footing there had been having given away beneath him without warning 30 minutes ago, leaving only the air-filled bubble of his jumper back ballooning lightly on the twilit water, until he rose to the surface and scrambled into the skiff. The house, the cabin, a little larger than a horse-box of cypress boards and an iron roof, rising on 10-foot stilts, slender as spiders' legs, like a shabby and death-stricken and probably poisonous wading creature which had got that far into that flat waste and died with nothing anywhere in reach or sight to lie down upon. A pirogue tied to the foot of a crude ladder, a man standing in the open door holding a lantern, it was that dark now, above his head, gobbling down at them. He told it, of the next 8 or 9 or 10 days, he did not remember which, while the four of them, himself and the woman and baby and the little wiry man with rotting teeth and soft, wild, bright eyes like a rat or a chipmunk, whose language neither of them could understand, lived in the room and a half. He did not tell it that way, just as he apparently did not consider it worth the breath to tell how he had got the 160-pound skiff single-handed up and across and down the 60-foot levee. He just said, "After a while we come to a house, and we stayed there 8 or 9 days. Then they blew up the levee with dynamite, so we had to leave." That was all. But he remembered it, but quietly now, with the cigar now, the good one the warden had given him, though not lighted yet, in his peaceful and steadfast hand, remembering that first morning when he waked on the thin pallet beside his host. The woman and baby had the one bed, with the fierce sun already latticed through the warped, rough planking of the wall, and stood on the rickety porch, looking out upon that flat, fecund waste, neither earth nor water, where even the senses doubted which rich and massy air, and which mazy and impalpable vegetation, and thought quietly, "He must do something here to eat and live, but I don't know what, and until I can go on again, until I can find where I am and how to pass that town without them seeing me, I will have to help him do it so we can eat and live, too, and I don't know what. And he had a change of clothing, too, almost at once on that first morning, not telling any more than he had about the skiff and the levee, how he had begged, borrowed, or bought from the man whom he had not laid eyes on 12 hours ago, and with whom on the day he saw him for the last time he still could exchange no word. The pair of dungaree pants, which even the Cajun had discarded as no longer wearable. Filthy, buttonless, the legs slashed and frayed into fringe like that on an 1890 hammock, in which he stood naked from the waist up and holding out to her the mud-caked and soot-stained jumper and overall, when the woman waked on that first morning in the crude bunk nailed into one corner and filled with dried grass, saying, "Wash them. Good. I want all them stains out. All of them." "But the jumper," she said, "ain't he got our old shirt, too? That sun and them mosquitoes." But he did not even answer, and she said no more either. Though when he and the Cajun returned at dark, the garments were clean, stained a little still with the old mud and soot, but clean, resembling again what they were supposed to resemble, as his arms and back already a fiery red, which would be blisters by tomorrow. He spread the garments out and examined them, and then rolled them up carefully in a 6 months-old New Orleans paper, and thrust the bundle behind a rafter, where it remained while day followed day, and the blisters on his back broke and suppurated. And he would sit with his face expressionless as a wooden mask beneath the sweat, while the Cajun doped his back with something on a filthy rag from a filthy saucer, she still saying nothing, since she too doubtless knew what his reason was, not from that rapport of the wedded conferred upon her by the 2 weeks during which they had jointly suffered all the crises, emotional, social, economic, and even moral, which do not always occur even in the ordinary 50 married years. The old married, you have seen them. The electroplate reproductions, the 1,000 identical coupled faces with only a collarless stud or a fichu out of Louisa Alcott to denote the sex, looking in pairs, like the winning braces of dogs after a field trial, out from among the packed columns of disaster and alarm and baseless assurance and hope and incredible insensitivity and insulation from tomorrow, propped by 1,000 morning sugar bowls or coffee urns, or singly, rocking on porches or sitting in the sun beneath the tobacco-stained porticos of 1,000 county courthouses, as though with the death of the other having inherited a sort of rejuvenescence, immortality. Relict, they take a new lease on breath and seem to live forever, as though that flesh which the old ceremony or ritual had morally purified and made legally one had actually become so with long, tedious habit, and he or she who entered the ground first took all of it with him or her, leaving only the old, permanent, enduring bone, free and trammelless. Not because of this, but because she too had stemmed at some point from the same dim, hill-bred Abraham. So the bundle remained behind the rafter, and day followed day, while he and his partner— he was in partnership now with his host, hunting alligators on shares, on the havers, he called it. "Havers," the plump convict said. "How could you make a business agreement with a man you claim you couldn't even talk to?" "I never had to talk to him," the tall one said. "Money ain't got but one language." Departed at dawn each day, at first together in the pirogue, but later singly, the one in the pirogue and the other in the skiff, the one with the battered and pitted rifle, the other with the knife and a piece of knotted rope and a light wood club, the size and weight and shape of a Thuringian mace, stalking their Pleistocene nightmares up and down the secret inky channels which writhed the flat, brass-colored land. He remembered that, too. That first morning when, turning in the sunrise from the rickety platform, he saw the hide nailed drying to the wall and stopped dead, looking at it quietly, thinking quietly and soberly. So that's it. That's what he does in order to eat and live. Knowing it was a hide, a skin, but from what animal, by association, ratiocination, or even memory of any picture out of his dead youth, he did not know, but knowing that it was the reason, the explanation for the little lost spider-legged house, which had already begun to die, to rot from the legs upward almost before the roof was nailed on, set in that teeming and myriad desolation, enclosed and lost within the furious embrace of flowing mare earth and stallion sun, divining through pure rapport of kind for kind, hillbilly and bayou rat, the two, one and identical, because of the same grudged dispensation and niggard fate of hard and unceasing travail, not to gain future security, a balance in bank or even in a buried soda can for slothful and easy old age, but just permission to endure, and endure to buy air to feel and sun to drink for each's little while, thinking, the convict, well, anyway, I am going to find out what it is sooner than I expected to, and did so. Re-entered the house where the woman was just waking in the one sorry built-in straw-filled bunk which the Cajun had surrendered to her, and ate the breakfast, the rice, a semi-liquid mess violent with pepper and mostly fish, considerably high, the chicory-thickened coffee, and shirtless followed the little scuttling, bobbing, bright-eyed, rotten-toothed man down the crude ladder and into the pirogue. He had never seen a pirogue either, and he believed that it would not remain upright. Not that it was light and precariously balanced with its open side upward, but that there was inherent in the wood, the very log, some dynamic and unsleeping natural law, almost will, which its present position outraged and violated. Yet accepting this too, as he had the fact that that hide had belonged to something larger than any calf or hog, and that anything which looked like that on the outside would be more than likely to have teeth and claws too. Accepting this, squatting in the pirogue, clutching both gunwales, rigidly immobile, as though he had an egg filled with nitroglycerin in his mouth, and scarcely breathing, thinking, if that's it, then I can do it too. And even if he can't tell me how, I reckon I can watch him and find out. And he did this, too. He remembered it, quietly even yet, thinking, I thought that was how to do it, and I reckon I would still think that, even if I had to do it again now for the first time. The brazen day already fierce upon his naked back, the crooked channel like a voluted thread of ink, the pirogue moving steadily to the paddle, which both entered and left the water without a sound. Then the sudden cessation of the paddle behind him, and the fierce hissing gobble of the Cajun at his back, and he, squatting, bait-breathed and with that intense immobility of complete sobriety of a blind man, listening, while the frail wooden shell stole on at the dying apex of its own parted water. Afterward, he remembered the rifle, too, the rust-pitted, single-shot weapon with a clumsily wired stock and a muzzle you could have driven a whiskey cork into, which the Cajun had brought into the boat. But not now. Now he just squatted, crouched immobile, breathing with infinitesimal care, his sober, unceasing gaze going here and there constantly as he thought, what? What? I not only don't know what I am looking for, I don't even know where to look for it. Then he felt the motion of the pirogue as the Cajun moved, and then the tense gobbling, hissing, actually, hot, rapid, and repressed against his neck and ear, and glancing downward, saw projecting between his own arm and body from behind the Cajun's hand holding the knife, and glaring up again, saw the flat, thick spit of mud, which, as he looked at it, divided and became a thick, mud-colored log, which, in turn, seemed, still immobile, to leap suddenly against his retinae in three, no, four dimensions. Volume, solidity, shape, and another. Not fear, but pure and intense speculation. And he looking at the scaled, motionless shape, thinking not, it looks dangerous, but it looks big. Thinking, well, maybe a mule standing in a lot looks big to a man that never walked up to one with a halter before. Thinking, only if he could just tell me what to do, it would save time. The pirogue drawing nearer now, creeping now, with no ripple now even, and it seemed to him that he could even hear his companion's held breath, and he, taking the knife from the other's hand now, and not even thinking this, since it was too fast, a flash. It was not a surrender, not a resignation, it was too calm. It was a part of him. He had drunk it with his mother's milk and lived with it all his life. After all, a man can't only do what he has to do, with what he has to do it with what he has learned to the best of his judgment. And I reckon a hog is still a hog, no matter what it looks like. So here goes. Sitting still for an instant longer until the bow of the pirogue grounded lighter than the falling of a leaf and stepped out of it and paused just for one instant while the words, "It does look big," stood for just a second, unemphatic and trivial, somewhere where some fragment of his attention could see them, and vanished, and stooped, straddling, the knife driving even as he grasped the near foreleg. This all in the same instant, when the lashing tail struck him a terrific blow upon the back. But the knife was home. He knew that, even on his back in the mud, the weight of the thrashing beast longwise upon him, its ridged back clutched to his stomach, his arm about its throat, the hissing head clamped against his jaw, the furious tail lashing and flailing, the knife in his other hand probing for the life and finding it, the hot, fierce gush. And now, sitting beside the profound up-bellied carcass, his head again between his knees in the old attitude, while his own blood freshened the other which drenched him, thinking, "It's my dern nose again." So he sat there, his head, his streaming face, bowed between his knees in an attitude not of dejection, but profoundly bemused, contemplative, while the shrill voice of the Cajun seemed to buzz at him from an enormous distance. After a time, he even looked up at the antic, wiry figure bouncing hysterically about him, the face wild and grimacing, the voice gobbling and high, while the convict, holding his face carefully slanted so the blood would run free, looked at him with the cold intentness of a curator or custodian paused before one of his own glass cases. The Cajun threw up the rifle, cried, "Boom, boom, boom," flung it down, and in pantomime reenacted the recent scene, then whirled his hands again, crying, "Magnifique, magnifique, cent d'argent, mille d'argent, tout l'argent sous le ciel de Dieu." But the convict was already looking down again, cupping the coffee-colored water to his face, watching the constant bright carmine marblet, thinking, "It's a little late to be telling me that now," and not even thinking this long because presently they were in the pirogue again, the convict squatting again with that unbreathing rigidity, as though he were trying to hold his breath to decrease his very weight, the bloody skin in the bows before him, and he looking at it, thinking, "And I can't even ask him how much my half will be." But this not for long either, because as he was to tell the plump convict later, money has but one language. He remembered that, too. They were at home now, the skin spread on the platform, where, for the woman's benefit now, the Cajun once more went through the pantomime, the gun which was not used, the hand-to-hand battle. For the second time, the invisible alligator was slain amid cries. The victor rose and found this time that not even the woman was watching him. She was looking at the once more swollen and inflamed face of the convict.
"You mean it kicked you right in the face?" she said.
"Nah," the convict said harshly, savagely.
It never had to. I done seemed to got to where if that boy was to shoot me in the tail with a bean blower, my nose would bleed.
Remembered that, too, but he did not try to tell it. Perhaps he could not have. How two people who could not even talk to one another made an agreement which both not only understood, but which each knew the other would hold true and protect, perhaps for this reason, better than any written and witnessed contract. They even discussed and agreed somehow that they should hunt separately, each in his own vessel, to double the chances of finding prey. But this was easy. The convict could almost understand the words in which the Cajun said, "You do not need me and the rifle. We will only hinder you, be in your way." And more than this, they even agreed about the second rifle, that there was someone, it did not matter who, friend, neighbor, perhaps one in business in that line, from whom they could rent a second rifle in their two patois, the one bastard English, the other bastard French, the one volatile with his wild bright eyes and his voluble mouth full of stumps of teeth, the other sober, almost grim, swollen-faced and with his naked back blistered and scoriated like so much beef. They discussed this, squatting on either side of the pegged-out hide like two members of a corporation facing each other across a mahogany board table, and decided against it. The convict deciding, "I reckon not," he said. "I reckon if I had knowed enough to wait to start out with a gun, I still would. But since I done already started out without one, I don't reckon I'll change." Because it was a question of the money in terms of time, days. Strange to say, that was the one thing which the Cajun could not tell him, how much the half would be. But the convict knew it was half. He had so little of them. He would have to move on soon, thinking, the convict, "All this darn foolishness will stop soon, and I can get on back." And then suddenly he found that he was thinking, "We'll have to get on back." And he became quite still, and looked about at the rich, strange desert which surrounded him, in which he was temporarily lost in peace and hope, and into which the last 7 years had sunk like so many trivial pebbles into a pool, leaving no ripple. And he thought quietly, with a kind of bemused amazement, "Yes, I reckon I had done forgot how good making money was, being let to make it." So he used no gun, his the knotted rope and the Thuringian mace, and each morning he and the Cajun took their separate ways in the two boats to comb and creep the secret channels about the lost land, from or out of which now and then still other pint-sized dark men appeared, gobbling, abruptly and as though by magic from nowhere, in other hollowed logs, to follow quietly and watch him at his single combats. Men named Tine and Toto and Teodul, who were not much larger than and looked a good deal like the muskrats which the Cajun, the host did this too, supplied the kitchen too. He expressed this too like the rifle business in his own tongue, the convict comprehending this too as though it had been English. "Do not concern yourself about food, O Hercules. Catch alligators. I will supply the pot." Took now and then from traps as you take a shoat pig at need from a pen, and varied the eternal rice and fish, the convict did tell this, how at night in the cabin the door and one sashless window battened against mosquitoes, a form, a ritual as empty as crossing the fingers or knocking on wood, sitting beside the bug-swirled lantern on the plank table in a temperature close to blood heat, he would look down at the swimming segment of meat on his sweating plate and think, "It must be Teodul. He was the fat one." Day following day, unemphatic and identical, each like the one before and the one which would follow, while his theoretical half of a sum to be reckoned in pennies, dollars, or tens of dollars, he did not know, mounted. The mornings when he set forth to find waiting for him, like the matador, his aficionados, the small clump of constant and deferential pirogues, the hard noons when, ringed half about by little motionless shells, he fought his solitary combats, the evenings, the return, the pirogues departing one by one into inlets and passages which during the first few days he could not even distinguish. Then the platform in the twilight, where before the static woman and the usually nursing infant and the one or two bloody hides of the day's take, the Cajun would perform his ritualistic victorious pantomime before the two growing rows of knife marks in one of the boards of the wall. Then the nights, when the woman and child in the single bunk and the Cajun already snoring on the pallet and the reeking lantern set close, he, the convict, would sit on his naked heels, sweating steadily, his face worn and calm, immersed and indomitable, his bowed back raw and savage as beef beneath the suppurant old blisters and the fierce welts of tails, and scrape and chip at the charred sapling which was almost a paddle now, pausing now and then to raise his head while the cloud of mosquitoes about it whined and whirled, to stare at the wall before him, until after a while the crude boards themselves must have dissolved away, and let his blank unseeing gaze go on and on unhampered, through the rich oblivious darkness, beyond it even perhaps beyond the 7 wasted years during which, so he had just realized, he had been permitted to toil but not to work. Then he would retire himself. He would take a last look at the rolled bundle behind the rafter, and blow out the lantern, and lie down as he was, beside his snoring partner. To lie sweating, on his stomach, he could not bear the touch of anything to his back. In the whining, oven-like darkness, filled with the forlorn bellowing of alligators, thinking not, they never gave me time to learn, but I had forgot how good it is to work. Then on the 10th day it happened. It happened for the 3rd time. At first he refused to believe it, not that he felt that now he had served out and discharged his apprenticeship to mischance, had, with the birth of the child, reached and crossed the crest of his Golgotha, and would now be, possibly not permitted, so much as ignored, to descend the opposite slope free-wheeling. That was not his feeling at all. What he declined to accept was the fact that a power, a force such as that which had been consistent enough to concentrate upon him with deadly undeviation for weeks, should, with all the wealth of cosmic violence and disaster to draw from, have been so barren of invention and imagination, so lacking in pride of artistry and craftsmanship as to repeat itself twice. Once he had accepted, twice he even forgave, but 3 times he simply declined to believe, particularly when he was at last persuaded to realize that this 3rd time was to be instigated not by the blind potency of volume and motion, but by human direction and hands, that now the cosmic joker, foiled twice, had stooped in its vindictive concentration to the employing of dynamite. He did not tell that. Doubtless he did not know himself how it happened, what was happening, but he doubtless remembered it, but quietly above the thick, rich-colored, pristine cigar in his clean, steady hand. What he knew, divined of it. It would be evening, the 9th evening, he and the woman on either side of their host's empty place at the evening meal, he hearing the voices from without but not ceasing to eat, still chewing steadily, because it would be the same as though he were seeing them anyway. The 2 or 3 or 4 pirogues floating on the dark water beneath the platform on which the host stood, the voices gobbling and jabbering, incomprehensible and filled not with alarm, and not exactly with rage or even perhaps absolute surprise, but rather just cacophony, like those of disturbed marsh fowl. He, The convict, not ceasing to chew, but just looking up quietly, and maybe without a great deal of interrogation or surprise, too, as the Cajun burst in and stood before them, wild-faced, glaring, his blackened teeth gaped against the inky orifice of his distended mouth, watching the convict while the Cajun went through his violent pantomime of violent evacuation, ejection, scooping something invisible into his arms and hurling it out and downward, and in the instant of completing the gesture, changing from instigator to victim of that which he had set into pantomimic motion. Clasping his head, and bowed over, and not otherwise moving, seeming to be swept on and away before it, crying, "Boom! Boom! Boom!" The convict watching him, his jaw not chewing now, though just for that moment, thinking, "What? What is it he is trying to tell me?" Thinking, this a flash too, since he could not have expressed this, and hence did not even know that he had ever thought it, that though his life had been cast here, circumscribed by this environment, accepted by this environment and accepting it in turn, and he had done well here, this quietly, soberly indeed, if he had been able to phrase it, think it, instead of merely knowing it, better than he had ever done, who had not even known until now how good work, making money, could be. Yet it was not his life. He still and would ever be no more than the water bug upon the surface of the pond, the plumbless and lurking depths of which he would never know, his only actual contact with it being the instance when, on lonely and glaring mud spits under the pitiless sun, and amphitheatered by his motionless and riveted semicircle of watching pirogues, he accepted the gambit which he had not elected, entered the lashing radius of the armed tail, and beat at the thrashing and hissing head with his lightwood club, or this, failing, embraced without hesitation the armored body itself, with the frail web of flesh and bone in which he walked and lived, and sought the raging life with an 8-inch knife blade. So he and the woman merely watched the Cajun as he acted out the whole charade of eviction. The little wiry man gesticulant and wild, his hysterical shadow leaping and falling upon the rough wall as he went through the pantomime of abandoning the cabin, gathering in pantomime his meager belongings from the walls and corners, objects which no other man would want, and only some power or force like blind water or earthquake or fire would ever dispossess him of. The woman watching, too, her mouth slightly open upon a mass of chewed food, on her face an expression of placid astonishment, saying, "What? What's he saying?" "I don't know," the convict said, "but I reckon if it's something we ought to know, we will find it out when it's ready for us to." Because he was not alarmed, though by now he had read the other's meaning plainly enough, "He's fixing to leave," he thought. "He's telling me to leave, too." This later, after they had quitted the table, and the Cajun and the woman had gone to bed, and the Cajun had risen from the pallet and approached the convict, and once more went through the pantomime of abandoning the cabin. This time, as one repeats a speech which may have been misunderstood, tediously, carefully repetitional as to a child, seeming to hold the convict with one hand while he gestured, talked, with the other, gesturing as though in single syllables. The convict, squatting, the knife open and the almost finished paddle across his lap, watching, nodding his head, even speaking in English, "Yeah, sure, you bet, I got you." Trimming again at the paddle, but no faster, with no more haste than on any other night, serene in his belief that when the time came for him to know whatever it was, that would take care of itself, having already, and without even knowing it, even before the possibility, the question ever arose, declined, refused to accept even the thought of moving, also thinking about the hides, thinking, "If there was just some way he could tell me where to carry my share to get the money," but thinking this only for an instant between two delicate strokes of the blade, because almost at once he thought, "I reckon as long as I can catch them, I won't have no big trouble finding whoever it is that will buy them." So the next morning he helped the Cajun load his few belongings, the pitted rifle, a small bundle of clothing. Again they traded, who could not even converse with one another. This time the few cooking vessels by definite allocation, and something embracing and abstractional which included the stove, the crude bunk, the house, or its occupancy. Something, in exchange for one alligator hide. A few rusty traps. Into the pirogue, then squatting, and as two children divide sticks, they divided the hides, separating them into two piles, one for me and one for you, two for me and two for you. And the Cajun loaded his share and shoved away from the platform and paused again, though this time he only put the paddle down, gathered something invisibly into his two hands, and flung it violently upward, crying, "Boom! Boom!" on a rising inflection, nodding violently to the half-naked and savagely scoriated man on the platform, who stared with a sort of grim equability back at him, and said, "Sure, boom, boom." Then the Cajun went on. He did not look back. They watched him already paddling rapidly, or the woman did. The convict had already turned.
"Maybe he was trying to tell us to leave, too," she said.
"Yeah," the convict said. "I thought of that last night. Hand me the paddle." She fetched it to him, the sapling, the one he had been trimming at nightly. Not quite finished, yet, though one more evening would do it. He had been using a spare one of the Cajun's. The other had offered to let him keep it, to include it, perhaps, with the stove and the bunk and the cabin's freehold, but the convict had declined. Perhaps he had computed it by volume against so much alligator hide, this weighed against one more evening with the tedious and careful blade. And he departed, too, with his knotted rope and mace in the opposite direction, as though not only not content with refusing to quit the place he had been warned against, he must establish and affirm the irrevocable finality of his refusal by penetrating even further and deeper into it. And then, and without warning, the high, fierce drowsing of his solitude gathered itself and struck at him. He could not have told this if he had tried. This not yet mid-morning, and he going on, alone for the first time, no pirogue emerging anywhere to fall in behind him. But he had not expected this anyway. He knew that the others would have departed too. It was not this. It was his very solitude, his desolation, which was now his alone and in full, since he had elected to remain. The sudden cessation of the paddle, the skiff shooting on for a moment yet, while he thought, "What? What?" Then, no, no, no. As the silence and solitude and emptiness roared down upon him in a jeering bellow, and now reversed, the skiff spun violently on its heel. He, the betrayed, driving furiously back toward the platform where he knew it was already too late. That citadel where the very crux and dear breath of his life, the being allowed to work and earn money, that right and privilege which he believed he had earned to himself unaided, asking no favor of anyone or anything save the right to be let alone, to pit his will and strength against the sauric protagonist of a land, a region which he had not asked to be projected into, was being threatened. Driving the homemade paddle in grim fury, coming in sight of the platform at last and seeing the motor launch lying alongside it with no surprise at all, but actually with a kind of pleasure, as though at a visible justification of his outrage and fear, the privilege of saying, "I told you so," to his own affronting, driving on toward it in a dreamlike state in which there seemed to be no progress at all, in which, unimpeded and suffocating, he strove dreamily with a weightless oar, with muscles without strength or resiliency, at a medium without resistance, seeming to watch the skiff creep infinitesimally across the sunny water and up to the platform, while a man in the launch, there were five of them in all, gobbled at him in that same tongue he had been hearing constantly now for 10 days and still knew no word of, just as a second man, followed by the woman carrying the baby and dressed again for departure in the faded tunic and the sunbonnet, emerged from the house. Carrying, the man carried several other things, but the convict saw nothing else. The paper-wrapped bundle which the convict had put behind the rafter 10 days ago, and no other hand had touched since. He, the convict, on the platform too now, holding the skiff's painter in one hand and the bludgeon-like paddle in the other, contriving to speak to the woman at last in a voice dreamy and suffocating and incredibly calm. "Take it away from him and carry it back to the house."
"So you can talk English, can you?" the man in the launch said. "Why didn't you come out like they told you to last night?"
"Out?" the convict said. Again he even looked, glared, at the man in the launch, contriving even again to control his voice.
"I ain't got time to take trips. I'm busy."
Already turning to the woman again, his mouth already open to repeat, as the dreamy, buzzing voice of the man came to him, and he, turning once more, in a terrific and absolutely unbearable exasperation, crying,
"Flood? What flood? Hell a mile, it's done past me twice, months ago. It's gone. What flood?"
And then, he did not think this in actual words either, but he knew it, suffered that flashing insight into his own character or destiny, how there was a peculiar quality of repetitiveness about his present fate, how not only the almost seminal crises recurred with a certain monotony, but the very physical circumstances followed a stupidly unimaginative pattern. The man in the launch said,
"Take him,"
and he was on his feet for a few minutes yet, lashing and striking in panting fury. Then once more, on his back, on hard, unyielding planks, while the four men swarmed over him in a fierce wave of hard bones and panting curses, and at last the thin, dry, vicious snapping of handcuffs.
"Damn it, are you mad?" the man in the launch said. "Can't you understand they are going to dynamite that levee at noon today? Come on," he said to the others. "Get him aboard. Let's get out of here."
"I want my hides and boat," the convict said.
"Damn your hides," the man in the launch said.
"If they don't get that levee blowed pretty soon, you can hunt plenty more of them on the Capitol steps at Baton Rouge. And this is all the boat you will need, and you can say your prayers about it."
"I ain't going without my boat," the convict said. He said it calmly and with complete finality. So calm, so final, that for almost a minute nobody answered him. They just stood, looking quietly down at him as he lay, half-naked, blistered and scarred, helpless and manacled hand and foot on his back, delivering his ultimatum in a voice peaceful and quiet as that in which you talk to your bedfellow before going to sleep. Then the man in the launch moved. He spat quietly over the side and said in a voice as calm and quiet as the convict's,
"All right. Bring his boat."
They helped the woman, carrying the baby and the paper-wrapped parcel, into the launch. Then they helped the convict to his feet and into the launch, too, the shackles on his wrists and ankles clashing.
"I'd unlock you if you'd promise to behave yourself," the man said.
The convict did not answer this at all. He said, "I want to hold the rope."
"The rope?"
"Yes," the convict said.
"The rope."
So they lowered him into the stern and gave him the end of the painter after it had passed the towing cleat, and they went on. The convict did not look back, but then he did not look forward either. He lay half sprawled, his shackled legs before him, the end of the skiff's painter in one shackled hand. The launch made two other stops. When the hazy wafer of the intolerable sun began to stand once more directly overhead, there were 15 people in the launch. And then the convict, sprawled and motionless, saw the flat, brazen land begin to rise and become a greenish-black mass of swamp, bearded and convoluted. This in turn stopping short off, and there spread before him an expanse of water embraced by a blue dissolution of shoreline and glittering thinly under the noon, larger than he had ever seen before, the sound of the launch's engine ceasing, the hull sliding on behind its fading bow wave.
"What are you doing?" the leader said.
"It's noon," the helmsman said. "I thought we might hear the dynamite." So they all listened, the launch lost of all forward motion, rocking slightly, the glitter-broken small waves slapping and whispering at the hull. But no sound, no tremble even, came anywhere under the fierce, hazy sky. The long moment gathered itself and turned on, and noon was past.
"All right," the leader said. "Let's go."
The engine started again. The hull began to gather speed. The leader came aft and stooped over the convict, key in hand.
"I guess you'll have to behave now, whether you want to or not," he said, unlocking the manacles.
"Won't you?"
"Yes," the convict said.
They went on. After a time, the shore vanished completely, and a little sea got up. The convict was free now, but he lay as before, the end of the skiff's painter in his hand, bent now with three or four turns about his wrist. He turned his head now and then to look back at the towing skiff as it slewed and bounced in the launch's wake. Now and then he even looked out over the lake, the eyes alone moving, the face grave and expressionless, thinking, "This is a greater immensity of water, of waste and desolation than I have ever seen before. Perhaps not." Thinking 3 or 4 hours later, the shoreline raised again and broken into a clutter of sailing sloops and power cruisers. "These are more boats than I believed existed, a maritime race of which I also had no cognizance." Or perhaps not thinking it, but just watching as the launch opened the shored gut of the ship canal, the low smoke of the city beyond it, then a wharf, the launch slowing in, a quiet crowd of people watching with that same forlorn passivity he had seen before, and whose race he did recognize, even though he had not seen Vicksburg when he passed it. The brand, the unmistakable hallmark of the violently homeless, he more so than any who would have permitted no man to call him one of them.
"All right," the leader said to him. "Here you are."
"The boat," the convict said.
"You've got it. What do you want me to do, give you a receipt for it?"
"No," the convict said. "I just want the boat."
"Take it. Only you ought to have a book strap or something to carry it in."
"Carry it in?" the plump convict said.
"Carry it where? Where would you have to carry it?"
He, the tall one, told that. How he and the woman disembarked, and how one of the men helped him haul the skiff up out of the water, and how he stood there with the end of the painter wrapped around his wrist, and the man bustled up, saying, "All right, next load, next load," and how he told this man, too, about the boat, and the man cried, "Boat, boat," and how he, the convict, went with them when they carried the skiff over and racked, berthed it with the others, and how he lined himself up by a Coca-Cola sign and the arch of a drawbridge, so he could find the skiff again quick when he returned, and how he and the woman, he carrying the paper-wrapped parcel, were herded into a truck, and after a while the truck began to run in traffic between close houses. Then there was a big building, an armory.
"Armory?" the plump one said.
"You mean a jail?"
"No, it was a kind of warehouse, with people with bundles laying on the floor."
And how he thought maybe his partner might be there, and how he even looked about for the Cajun while waiting for a chance to get back to the door again, where the soldier was, and how he got back to the door at last, the woman behind him, and his chest actually against the dropped rifle.
"Go on, go on," the soldier said. "Get back. They'll give you some clothes in a minute. You can't walk around the streets that way. and something to eat, too. Maybe your kinfolks will come for you by that time."
And he told that, too, how the woman said,
"Maybe if you told him you had some kinfolks here, he would let us out."
And how he did not. He could not have expressed this, either. It too deep, too ingrained. He had never yet had to think it into words through all the long generations of himself. His hillman's sober and jealous respect, not for truth, but for the power, the strength, of lying. Not to be niggered with lying, but rather to use it with respect and even care, delicate, quick, and strong, like a fine and fatal blade. And how they fetched him clothes, a blue jumper and overalls, and then food, too. A brisk, starched young woman saying,
"But the baby must be bathed, cleaned. It will die if you don't."
And the woman saying,
"Yes'm, he might holler some. He ain't never been bathed before. But he's a good baby."
And now it was night, the unshaded bulbs harsh and savage and forlorn above the snorers, and he rising, gripping the woman awake, and then the window. He told that, how there were doors in plenty leading he did not know where, but he had a hard time finding a window they could use, but he found one at last. He carrying the parcel and the baby, too, while he climbed through first.
"You oughta tore up a sheet and slid down it," the plump convict said.
But he needed no sheet. There were cobbles under his feet now in the rich darkness. The city was there, too, but he had not seen it yet, and would not. The low, constant glare. Bienville had stood there, too. It had been the figment of an emasculate also, calling himself Napoleon, but no more. Andrew Jackson had found it one step from Pennsylvania Avenue. But the convict found it considerably further than one step back to the ship canal and the skiff, the Coca-Cola sign dim now, the drawbridge arching spidery against the jonquil sky at dawn. Nor did he tell any more than about the 60-foot levee, how he got the skiff back into the water. The lake was behind him now. There was but one direction he could go. When he saw the river again, he knew it at once. He should have. It was now ineradicably a part of his past, his life. It would be a part of what he would bequeath if that were in store for him. But 4 weeks later it would look different from what it did now, and did. He, the old man, had recovered from his debauch back in Banks again. The old man, rimpling placidly toward the sea, brown and rich as chocolate between levees whose inner faces were wrinkled as though in a frozen and aghast amazement, crowned with the rich green of summer in the willows. Beyond them, 60 feet below, slick mules squatted against the broad pull of middle busters in the richened soil, which would not need to be planted, which would need only to be shown a cottonseed to sprout and make. There would be the symmetric miles of strong stalks by July, purple bloom in August. In September, the black fields snowed over, spilled, the middles dragged smooth by the long sacks, the long black limber hands plucking, the hot air filled with the wine of gins. The September air then, but now June air, heavy with locust and the town's smell of new paint and the sour smell of the paste which holds wallpaper. The towns, the villages, the little lost wood landings on stilts on the inner face of the levee, the lower stories bright and rank under the new paint and paper, and even the marks on spile and post and tree of May's raging water height, fading beneath each bright silver gust of summer's loud and inconstant rain. There was a store at the levee's lip, a few saddled and rope-bridled mules in the sleepy dust, a few dogs, a handful of Negroes sitting on the steps beneath the chewing tobacco and malaria medicine signs, and three white men, one of them a deputy sheriff canvassing for votes to beat his superior, who had given him his job,
in the August primary, all pausing to watch the skiff emerge from the glitter glare of the afternoon water, and approach and land. A woman carrying a child stepping out, then a man, a tall man, who, approaching, proved to be dressed in a faded but recently washed and quite clean suit of penitentiary clothing, stopping in the dust where the mules dozed and watching with pale, cold, humorless eyes, while the deputy sheriff was still making toward his armpit that gesture which everyone present realized was to have produced a pistol in one flashing motion. For a considerable time, while still nothing came of it, it was apparently enough for the newcomer, however. "You are officer," he said.
"You damn right I am," the deputy said. "Just let me get this damn gun."
"All right," the other said. "Yonder's your boat, and here's the woman. But I never did find that bastard on the cotton house."